Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to The World in 10 from the Times of London. This podcast keeps you on top of the most important developments across the world. I'm James Hansen. Now, previously, we've brought you all types of stories. We have now, though, as of this week, narrowed our focus to global security, conflicts, diplomatic relations, and cybersecurity. As part of our focus on global security, we're partnering with Frontline, an interview series from Times Radio, available on YouTube with expert analysis on the world's conflicts. I'm one of Frontline's presenters. It's going to be a regular feature from now on that we bring you Frontline interviews in full on Saturdays and Sundays, which means our episodes on Saturdays and Sundays will be a little longer. But from Monday to Friday, we are very much still The World in 10. The interview we bring you today is with Michael Binion. Michael's been a writer, columnist, and foreign correspondent with The Times since 1972. And Michael spoke to me earlier this week about how a withdrawal of Chinese support could possibly force President Putin to the negotiating table over Ukraine. Here's our conversation.
Michael, welcome to Frontline.
Thank you. Hello.
First of all, I just wonder if you can give us your assessment of where you think we are with this conflict at the moment.
Well, it's pretty bogged down, but at the moment the advantage is with the Russians, and the Ukrainians are really on the back foot. They're suffering all along that eastern front line. They're having difficulty holding the line. The Russians are pushing forward quite hard, and the Ukrainians are desperately hoping that the promised aid and ammunition, which the Americans have finally released, is on its way as soon as possible.
And that's a key point, isn't it? Because although, understandably, there is a great sense among many Western allies of Ukraine that, you know, it's a landmark moment, the US finally approving this aid package, really is how quickly it can be delivered to the front line.
Absolutely. They need the ammunition especially right now, and they need anti-aircraft defence, the ATACMS, the Patriot, also things to shoot down the Russian missiles and drones, which are raining down, and the Russians have really stepped up their attacks on the infrastructure in Ukraine, particularly energy, water, things of that kind, and also general attacks on the cities. Kharkiv is suffering terribly. There's been a lot of bombing there. A lot of flats and houses are destroyed. And the Ukrainians need some kind of defence against all this. So it's not just a question of promising the money. They need not just money, they need weapons, and they need them on the ground now.
I was going to ask you about Kharkiv, actually, because it's interesting that General Siersky reportedly has deployed more resources and troops to that area, because there is a fear that the Russians may try and launch a full-scale ground offensive on it. Do you think, realistically, Russia has the capability to take it?
Well, at the moment, if the Ukrainians don't have proper air defence, and if they don't have enough missiles and things, anti-missile weapons ready, the Russians could. I mean, they could take it. It depends how much they go for it. If they do a full-scale air assault and just try to bomb everything flat, I mean, that would be at tremendous cost, both in terms of civilian casualties and in terms of the destruction. But it depends whether the Russians feel that this is a strategic objective that they can take now and may not be able to take later on. And if they do think that, they may be tempted to launch something. I mean, there's been talk of a new Russian offensive this coming month in May. The ground is favourable. The deployments of the Russians have got plenty of forces up near the front line. And, of course, the symbolic value would be immense, because Kharkiv is Ukraine's second city. I mean, it was very much a Soviet city in Soviet times. I mean, Kharkov, as it was called, and it's a city that the Russians feel should be part of Russia. They're desperate to take it, and it would be an incredible loss for the Ukrainians, both in morale and in terms of actual surrendering important territory, if it fell.
And you would have thought it would make sense for Russia, if they are going to launch such an offensive, to do it in the next few weeks, because that is the period before the full impact of this aid will be felt.
Absolutely, yes. And the other thing is that the Ukrainians are really suffering from manpower shortage. It's not just a shortage of weapons, but they have tremendous gaps in their manpower. Some of the people who've been fighting have been fighting for more than a year without any break. And frankly, soldiers, when they're totally exhausted and demoralized and fed up, they don't fight well. And you need to refresh them, you need to change them around. But there just aren't the number of people. I mean, there have been a large number of casualties. The Ukrainians won't say exactly how many, but we know it's tens of thousands. And there is an attempt to lower the recruitment age down to, I think it's 25 from 27. Anyway, to lower it so they get more young people. And to be honest, quite a lot of young people don't want to be called up, particularly when they think that the chances of getting killed are very high. So there is quite a lot of draft dodging. Quite a lot of people are trying to leave the country. The Ukrainians are now tightening up on border controls, trying to make sure that they're not allowed out if they're of military age. And unless they can actually supply their armed forces with more manpower, then they're going to have a real problem.
Just going back to the USA package, what do you think shifted the attitudes of certain key Republicans? I mean, you even saw a kind of subtle change in Donald Trump's language towards Ukraine in the last few weeks that probably allowed some Republicans to vote for it. And of course, we have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and some hardliners who are still very opposed to the package. But of course, you know, Mike Johnson and others pushed for it. What do you think led to that change?
Interesting. Hard to say exactly. I think it's the perception that if America didn't provide something, a key American concern, a deployment of an engagement of the last 3 years or 2.5 years would be all in vain, and that the Americans would be seen as reneging on their allies and on their treaties and on their promises and on everything. And that would set a very bad example for American morale, really American reputation around the world, particularly among allies. And I think the warnings to the Republicans were pretty stark. You know, unless you allow this money to go through, then Ukraine will lose. And it's as stark as that. And I think the message got through, particularly as it was tied up with aid to Israel at the same time. Mm. And of course, a lot of Republicans quite happy to do that and to allow aid for Israel. And then the question became, well, if you allow aid to one ally, why not not allowing aid to another, well, not a formal ally, but another friendly country that we're trying to support? And I think the message got through. And also, I have to say, Mike Johnson got a bit braver. You know, yeah. He was ready to face down the naysayers. I mean, he was always worried that, you know, they would then try and turf him out of office as Speaker. But actually, it paid off because the attempt to get rid of him, I mean, it just fizzled out.
But do you think this is a fundamental shift in Republican attitudes to Ukraine, or do you think this is a bit of a one-off? I mean, if in 6 to 12 months' time, there will almost certainly need to be even more US military aid to Ukraine, do you think the Republicans would back it then?
Well, it's hard to say. I think it is a bit of a one-off. I mean, it's a question of having promised, you know, will you deliver? But I don't think in future there will be promises will be made so easily unless the administration sounds out whether or not the Republicans are willing to back it. And of course, later this year, we're coming right close to the election. And if we're right in the middle of an election campaign, I think a lot of people, and particularly Trump, if he's the nominee, which looks fairly certain, he will say, we don't need to spend money on this. We need to spend money on our own interests and, you know, making America strong and great again. And what's Ukraine for us? Why are we giving all this money? It's in Europe. Aren't the Europeans looking after it themselves? You know, why should we keep pouring money into a bottomless pit?
But Trump's central argument, actually, that he's been making over recent years, although he's been making it in very crass terms, is right, is it not, that actually America for too long has basically funded Europe's defence policy, and European countries, particularly NATO members, need to spend more of their overall spending on defence. And we're starting to see moves in that direction. But Trump is right on that point, isn't he?
Oh, yes. I think there's no question about that. The Europeans have all heard that message and reacted to it. That's not quite the same as helping Ukraine. I mean, what Trump is saying is that European membership of NATO is dependent on them paying their share. And even if they pay 2% or more than 2%, even then, America will still pay by far the largest share of the running costs of NATO and all the equipment and, well, everything. America will still have a much larger share and, in absolute terms, a far higher amount of money will be paid in by the Americans. But the Europeans have heard that message, and they've been saying it themselves. You know, we really ought to up our game a bit, and particularly those that are below 2%, which include big countries such as Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, Germany's made a big commitment that they will increase their defence budget, but, you know, it needs to be increased pretty quickly. And then some other countries that have really thought that defence doesn't matter terribly much, you know, countries that have sort of fairly far away and fairly peaceful. Well, for example, Spain and Portugal, or even some of the southern European countries in NATO, they don't see the urgency or haven't seen the urgency. But I think they will see it now. The only countries that have really seen it and have seen it for some time are those in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Close to the, I mean, Poland, for example, spends
3.9%.
Well, exactly. Almost double what Britain pays, not in terms of money, but in terms of percentage per head.
Yeah.
That is a lot. And they see the urgency straight away. And Britain has always been fairly far out front. But I have to say, even Britain's contribution has relatively declined in the past 10 or 15 years. You know, the peace dividend, as it was called, seems to have been that we've the army is well below force. We've got real problems with equipment. We haven't got enough. We've not manufactured things that work. We've been spending a lot of money on tanks that make all those in it go deaf. So, I mean, not very successful record so far.
Well, that's a very good point, because obviously we had the announcement last week that the UK, well, Rishi Sunak has pledged to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. Now, whether Rishi Sunak will still be Prime Minister then is another issue. But of course, even if you're going to spend more on defence, we in the UK have had massive issues with defence procurement, so there's an issue there to be resolved.
Absolutely, yes. And of course, some people say, well, we don't need to simply spend more money. What we need to do is stop wasting the money that is allocated already, because some of the money for defence procurement goes on things that simply either don't work or are out of date or frankly useless. You know, you build a great aircraft carrier and then you don't have any planes to, you know, land on it. So what's the point of that? Or things that really don't sort of hang together. And the basic things, like how many soldiers do you have? I mean, that has been shamefully neglected. The army is at its smallest strength for more than 100 years. I mean, it seems absurd that we're just not recruiting people into the Army and Navy particularly, so that they can't actually man the ships that have been commissioned.
And there was a story recently in the Times about recruitment delays in the Army, so the people are actually dropping out mid-process because it's taking so long for their application to go through.
Well, they just need to up their game. They need to get that sorted out. I mean, that shouldn't be too difficult. That's just bureaucratic incompetence and procurement incompetence as well. I mean, they need to have a real think about how do you use the money effectively, A, to buy equipment, and B, to recruit those you need to recruit. And here it's not just a question of money, it's a question of actually getting the thing done properly.
Just to go back to Rishi Sunak's announcement, he made that announcement as part of a trip to first Poland and then Germany. And it was interesting that he chose to visit Berlin, I think, because as you mentioned, Michael, you know, German defence spending maybe isn't at the levels that a lot of people would argue it should be. But one of the big issues is whether Germany should provide these long-range Taurus missiles to Ukraine. And there seems to be a division actually within the governing coalition between Olaf Scholz and his SDP party, who seem reluctant to provide them. And then you've got the Greens, ironically, given they're seen as actually being to the left of the SDP, more hawkish on Ukraine and seemingly more interested in supplying these Taurus missiles. What do you think is going on there?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. Well, the SDP has a long history of Ostpolitik, I mean, opening up to the East, particularly in communist times. And the SDP, Olaf Scholz's party, has long been very reluctant to antagonise Russia. Now, this goes back a long, long way, of course, because of German war guilt, and particularly because the fight against Russia was extremely bloody and, you know, millions of Russians were killed, and there's a great feeling that never again will we attack Russians in that way. Now, as long as the spending for Ukraine was to equip and help the Ukrainian army and arm the Ukrainians with missiles, fine. But if it's a question of giving missiles to the Ukrainians that would then go on to be used to attack Russian cities and targets far and deep inside Russia, then there's a real reluctance. The feeling is, well, the Germans effectively are taking part in a war against Russia, giving the weapons to destroy Russian targets and cities. And there's a feeling that that really is a step too far. Public opinion feels that. Now, others have said, well, if you're waging a war, you can't sort of limit what your targeting is. You've got to, you know, you've got to really use all the resources you can and hit where you can. There's a sort of real argument going on there. Now, why the Greens are more hawkish, I'm not sure, but the Greens, for some time, they've been quite, how should I say, realistic about foreign policy. They're realistic about how things actually happen and work. They have a very soft green agenda domestically on things like environment, you know, nuclear power and all that sort of thing. But when it comes to defending Germany's interests as a nation, and particularly its defence interests, they're certainly no pacifists.
Mm. It's very interesting, and actually probably reminds us that even though there are green parties all over the world, they're very different in each country. And for example, you know, Jill Stein, the big Green candidate in America, and her politics compared to the Green Party in the UK. And of course, there are several different Green parties in the UK because the English party is separate to the Scottish. They are all very different in their way.
Yes. I mean, the unifying factor is tremendous concern about the environment, which is the overriding interest. But those policies have been stolen by a lot of other parties as well. I mean, the environment is a popular flag for every party to wave at the elections. Of course, it depends how much each party is promising to spend on that. We've just seen that Labour has got into a bit of trouble by having a commitment for 28 billion, I think it was, which they've now said, well, you know, when possible we'll spend that. You know, we're not committing to that figure. But the Greens, therefore, don't have a particularly unifying factor. They are generally fairly far left of centre. It depends how you define the centre, but they're sort of progressive, as it were, left-wing, but they're not old-fashioned socialists in the way that we're thinking of sort of the left-wing in the 1930s and 40s. It's not that sort of socialism. And for them, what matters much more is protecting the environment, protecting, nature, making sure that we don't use up all our resources, and things of that kind. I mean, they've got a sort of new way of thinking about how cities and societies should be organised. And each party has slightly different views. I mean, some are tremendously hostile to nuclear power, such as in Germany. But the problem is that for many Greens now, it's been shown that nuclear power actually produces no carbon emissions. So it's actually not a bad way of providing energy, you know, as long as it's safe. It isn't going to pollute the atmosphere.
And just to go back to the issue of the Taurus missiles, I mean, Olaf Scholz, in fairness, would say one of his arguments against providing them is that he believes German soldiers would be required on the ground to help program the missiles. Now, that is disputed by some, but of course it feeds into what you were describing, Michael, about the fear of escalation and being drawn into a full-blown conflict between NATO and Russia. Do you think that is realistic, though? Because we have heard since the start of the full-scale invasion fears about Putin potentially using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, fears about some major escalation. So far, that hasn't come to pass. How would you assess that risk?
Yes, well, the risk is there, but I think the Russians are under pretty strict restrictions, both from their main ally, China, who's warned them several times publicly as well as privately, don't you think of using nuclear weapons? Because the Chinese know that, you know, then World War III starts, or, you know, absolutely uncontrollable consequences if they start doing that. And equally, I think public opinion within Russia would be very hostile to the idea of nuclear weapons that could expose Russians also to a counterattack. Now, as for the Germans feeling that they are getting involved, by having people on the ground helping man these missiles. Well, that is a perfectly real fear, and it's not unreasonable, because actually several countries have clandestinely put their own experts on the ground to help Ukraine either train or, you know, use or launch or do whatever they need to do with weapons with which the Ukrainians are not familiar. And there have been reports that there are quite a number of undercover Western military advisors or actually experts on the ground with Ukrainians. The Russians are well aware of that. The Russians have tried to stop that by bombing supply lines or targeting ammunition dumps where these things are delivered inside Ukraine. But it's a bit difficult for them because the Western governments have all denied that they're officially entering into a direct armed association with Ukraine. They're saying we're simply supplying, you know, what they need in terms of weapons and defence. But inevitably, there are people on the ground.
Yeah. And I suppose the crucial question is it possible for Ukraine to win this war without escalating the conflict?
That's a very good question. I mean, it depends how you define winning. Is it possible for them to get back all the territory now occupied by Russia? Frankly, the answer is no. It's not going to happen. They're not going to get the Russians particularly out of Crimea. And actually, I'm not sure for all their talk whether the West really will push Ukrainians into open, you know, full-scale war to the point where they've got the Russians retreating back behind the 2014 frontiers, in other words, withdrawing from Crimea. The West was fairly mute when the Russians occupied Crimea, partly because there was a sort of feeling that Crimea actually, historically, has always been Russian. It was only in 1954 that Khrushchev signed it over to Ukraine. And in those days, it didn't matter. It was all the same country. It was all part of the Soviet Union. So there isn't that sort of feeling that Ukraine must go on all the way to win. Now, victory could mean less than getting all the territory back. It could mean simply showing Moscow that they have failed in their objective of subordinating the entire country to Moscow, that most of Ukraine is free and independent and will not necessarily do what Moscow wants. And that could be a real definition of victory, and it could indeed be very damaging to Putin.
Is it unrealistic, though, for Ukraine to recapture Crimea? Because there would be some who say, look at the success that Ukraine, a country essentially without a navy, has had at eliminating much of the Black Sea fleet. Obviously, it's targeted the Kerch Bridge in the past. If they were able to destroy or partially destroy the Kerch Bridge, that would be a severe blow to Russia. Is it really out of the question they could retake Crimea?
No, it's not out of the question. I just think it's politically more difficult for them to persuade the Allies to back them to a full-scale assault, getting the all Russian forces out of Crimea. You're right, they have had enormous success, unexpected success almost, in their naval operations. They've managed to target Russian ships, they've sunk quite a few, they've forced the Russians to withdraw from the ports in Crimea, Sevastopol in particular, move further east to Russian ports, the other side of the water there. I think that the Russians would double down enormously if they really thought that Crimea itself was actually about to be retaken. I think they would launch everything they've got to make sure that doesn't happen. But in terms of being able to hit Russian forces, the Ukrainians have been quite successful, particularly with their longer-range missiles, at hitting ammunition dumps, at hitting strategic supply points, and also Russian bases.
And tactically, do you think we will see that continue from Ukraine, particularly with the provision now of these attackums again from the US, that they will go after some of the energy infrastructure that Russia has whilst obviously trying to defend their positions on the front line?
Undoubtedly. I mean, that would be the sensible thing to do. I mean, I'm sure that's what their military advisors would tell them to do. And they need to target the airfields and the bases where a lot of Russian attacks are launched from. They need to actually hit energy infrastructures in the same way that the Russians have done and are still doing in Ukraine. Yes, but of course, again, you get to the point where to what extent are the Western allies ready to allow the Ukrainians to use Western weapons for direct assaults on Russia proper beyond the territory that has been occupied? Are they ready for long-range hits, say, on Moscow or wherever they might try to bomb? I think the answer is the West would be fairly reluctant.
But wouldn't that wouldn't that bring things to a head in a way that may work out in Ukraine's favour? Because, you know, at the moment, for many ordinary Russians, the war feels quite distant. It doesn't affect their day-to-day lives. If there were regular strikes on big Russian cities, surely that would increase the pressure internally on Putin.
Yes, well, I can tell you about one city in particular that I know quite well, namely Belgorod, down in the south, where I have spent several years teaching English to students in Belgorod. A lovely city. It's a sort of medium-sized town, neither rich, neither poor, neither big, neither small. It's a typical, quite well-to-do southern town, and they have had attacks on them, and people have been killed, and they are quite worried and upset and scared, and it does come home to them very much in a big way there. But that's because it's right close to the Ukrainian border. Now, several of the other big cities haven't really seen that. I mean, there have been symbolic attacks on Moscow. We've had drones that have actually hit buildings and done something, but we haven't had widespread casualties or anything like that. And I don't think the average Russian does really feel that the war is all around them. Of course, the average young person does worry that any moment now they may be recruited yes. into the military, and that is a very real threat. And particularly the elite youth, as it were, in Moscow and Petersburg, either they've fled or they're hoping that the military recruitment will not pick them up, because that could cause a lot of upset in influential places.
And do you think Putin will do that at some point, or do you think he'd be reluctant to because of the internal unrest it would cause if he does, for example, conscript younger, more middle-class people, you know, from the big cities of Moscow and St. Petersburg?
Well, so far, he has been very reluctant to do that, which suggests he would still be reluctant. It depends how urgently they need more forces. Depends how reckless they are with their own casualties. I mean, they have a very poor record of saving lives on the front line. They just throw in wave after wave. I mean, some of them, they say, well, these were prisoners. You know, these were people who, they took the bargain. You know, they would be free if they joined up and fought on the front line, and they got killed. Well, that was their choice, as it were. They are trying to induce people into the armed services by paying enormous amounts of money. I mean, six times the average wage for those who join up, and promises to their families if they are killed or if they are injured. That may keep up some of the flow of recruits. But actually, military conscription, a new wave of conscription, Putin has been reluctant to do that. And it depends how tough the situation gets for Russia, whether they will or need to do that.
Just finally, Michael, what would be the best-case scenario for the spring and summer for Ukraine? Would it be to get to the end of the summer having lost no further territory? Would it be to actually have made some advances? Do you think that's at all feasible? What do you think is the best-case scenario for Ukraine over the next couple of months?
Well, certainly the best case is not to lose any more territory and, if possible, to regain some of the territory that they have recently lost. Now, to be honest, the territory they've lost is an absolute wasteland. It's been just, frankly, devastated. It looks like the front line of the First World War. I mean, just ruined cities, unexploded ordnance. It's not valuable territory, but it's further closer to the original frontier. Or some spectacular successes, such as having sunk a few more ships, or having hit one or two main military ammunition dumps in Russia, or something of that kind, a sort of morale-boosting success, and particularly something where using new TACMs, using new missiles, they find that they've got much more confidence, they're not losing the same number of their own men, they are actually having some effect, and that their Russians are certainly not advancing. It's going to be very hard to take territory back across a very well-reinforced front line that runs all the way down that eastern flank that the Russians have had for the past more or less 2 years almost. And that is well-fortified with all kinds of tank traps and, lines of defence. Very hard to attack across that. As people have found, and, war experts say, it's much easier to defend a front line than it is to attack across it. And the chances of Ukraine actually being able to, sweep back, push the Russians right out, I think are fairly small. Therefore, the aim is to force Russia into some kind of offer of a ceasefire. Now, that pressure may come from China as well, that would like Russia to stop all this. I mean, the Chinese, they're not happy about it. They're giving political support and quite a lot of material support to the Russians, but they're not happy. And they've told Russia, they've said we can mediate. which suggests they would like to see a ceasefire. Now, Putin probably will not even think of that till the American election, because if Trump comes in, he doesn't need to do anything more, really. Trump will probably say, okay, well, let's just call it a day. You know, you keep what you got and that's it, which would be bad for the Ukrainians.
So a combination maybe of Biden, were he to be re-elected, and Xi Jinping putting pressure on Vladimir Putin could bring this war to an end in a way that favours Ukraine.
Well, it certainly could bring the war to an end in that Ukraine will not be occupied and made a satellite of Russia. Some of the territory, I'm afraid, will be lost forever. I can't see that the Ukrainians, with Western support, will get back all the territory Russia has occupied. And to be absolutely honest, if I was the government in Kiev, I would think that some of those eastern flanks have been a real nuisance, because they were the separatists who started agitating in the first place, which led the Russians to say, we're coming to defend our brethren, and, you know, Ukraine should give more autonomy to this region, which is how the whole thing began in the first place.
But some would say that was a false flag operation, essentially stirred up by Moscow.
Oh, of course it was stirred up, but there is genuine feeling there that a lot of people were fairly bitter about the way they were treated by the government in Kiev.
Well, whatever happens, there's no doubt we're in store for some very, very interesting months. Michael Binion, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with former Times foreign correspondent Michael Binion on Frontline, the interview series from Times Radio. We'll bring you another Frontline interview tomorrow on The World in 10. Thank you for taking the time to stay on top of the world with the help of the Times of London.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.